Hello and welcome back to another episode of Fund Friday with a very special guest today. This guy is a absolute stud and a boss in what he is doing in multiple spaces in the industry. But everyone, please welcome the founder of Kasman Capital Group and the host of the podcast Multifamily Insights, John Kasman. How are you today?
Hey, Craig, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for coming on. I think we spoke over the summertime when there was no deal flow going on, just to get reacquainted and to study up with what one another is up to. So would love to re-pick up that conversation here today, of course. But before we get into all that good stuff, just tell us a bit about who you are, how you got to where you are today, and maybe what you were doing before real estate, or maybe you got into real estate right away.
Yeah, so the short version of that story is, I used to be in corporate America, like a lot of your listeners. I was in advertising and marketing for 15 years, and I worked at General Motors at one point. And early in my career, I was there when we went through bankruptcy. And kind of leading up into bankruptcy, we started to see the writing on the wall a little bit. I remember there was a day we had done a contract with 50 Cent. So I used to work on the Pontiac team. We had a contract with him and it had lapsed and we had already negotiated the new agreement. He went out and did some stuff on our behalf while we were waiting to sign the new agreement. And about a week later, once I had the contract, finance department called me and said, "You cannot sign that contract." I'm like, "What are you talking about? He's already done stuff for us." And in short, we found out that there were some issues with the company's health financially. And of course, all that came out over the coming months. But I remember watching what that was like, experiencing it, the anxiety I felt, went through multiple rounds of layoffs. And even though I was quote unquote safe, that secure job I had didn't feel very secure. And if you can imagine what it may feel like to have your company, on the news and the threat of losing your job, I think that's the fear for most W-2 employees, right? Is you work a good job, you do everything you're supposed to do. And at any moment, not because of anything you've done, that security gets taken from under you. How are you going to pay for your bills? How do you take care of your family? All those things. So that led me into a plan B, which ultimately became real estate. I started to learn about real estate investing, moved out of Detroit back in 2011, learned everything I could, bought a two-unit building that went really well, bought a three-unit, bought an eight-unit building, really wanted to scale into commercial multifamily. And from there, I hired a mentor. I read everything I could read. I networked my butt off and we started to scale into larger deals. And the first deal we did that was a syndication was actually 192 units in Texas. And once that deal was under our belts, we were kind of off to the races. So
That's awesome. And what year did you kind of, obviously you mentioned that it was around the 2007, 2009 window where you saw the corporate writing on the wall. Maybe this just wasn't something you wanted to do long term. But when did you kind of really, I guess, start investing and, raising for multifamily and just real estate projects in general?
yeah, so I started with my own portfolio and I knew real estate was a path to financial freedom and financial independence and time flexibility and all these things. So I really wanted to embark upon that path. But again, it was 2009, 2010, and I'm in Detroit. And if you recall the headlines at that time, you could buy a property for a dollar in Detroit.
I
And
remember that, yeah.
I didn't know much about real estate investing. I read the book, so I had these theories. But I knew if you could buy a property for a dollar, there was a reason. There was a catch. People didn't really want these properties. So
No
I
free
was
lunch.
hesitant. Yeah, exactly. So I was hesitant to move at that time. But once I moved to Chicago, I felt like, okay, this market feels a little more secure. We don't have the same, dependency on the automotive industry. So that's when I got comfortable investing. So from 2012 is when I started my personal portfolio, started building slowly. And then around 2016, around the end of 2016, is when I started to really focus on scaling into larger commercial apartment buildings. And that was around the time that I started working with other partners and learning everything I could, hiring the mentors and all those things.
That's awesome. And I can't imagine how valuable, timing can really be, especially if you play on your side, right? Because naturally I'm thinking, okay, 2016, 2017, Trump got into office then where, real estate, the bull run that we saw in this last market cycle, I'm sure rode up. So did you kind of, really benefit off that from a track record perspective, really having deals that went well in a market that was just, turning into a bull market in front of our
Yeah, I mean,
eyes?
I think everybody who bought at that time did well. The challenge, though, is that if you recall being in that market, there was a whole lot of fear mongering. I recall being at an event and a very well-known speaker, a very respected speaker, told me the market's going to crumble. You need to sell some of your assets. This was 2017. I just bought my first real commercial property, and here I was, oh crap, the market's going to fall. I don't want to lose my money. We got to get this thing positioned to exit, right? And of course, everything ran all the way up. Fast forward to 2020, right? I'm sure we all got same feedback, similar advice. Oh, this is it, right? This is that black swan event. Your real estate is going to go down in value. You got to sell now, right? Everybody who sold is looking back like, oh man, wow. Things really ran up over the next couple of years. And here we are back again today with those same, feelings and sentiments being out there. Now, I'm not suggesting that these individuals are wrong or misinformed or anything like that. What I am saying is you need to tune out the noise and focus on the fundamentals when it comes to investing. And that was the big thing for me is I don't get caught up on the bull run, the bear run, and all that kind of crap. I feel like it's way too trendy and transactional and trying to time the market. And I think that really is it's hurtful to investors, particularly newer investors or passive investors, because the goal is not to buy a property at its absolute lowest value and then sell it at the absolute maximum value. The goal is to put yourself in a position financially where you can change your own life, where you can get on the path, you can diversify your income, you can reduce your taxes, you can get the cash flow. And that is going to be a consistent challenge for all of us. So I don't really care about where we're at in the cycle. What I want to do is make sure that we are investing with a long-term view, and we can go in and obviously want to buy properties as low as possible. But the real key here for us is to sell when it makes sense to sell. And if we have that control, if we give ourselves that flexibility, we're going to protect ourselves and continue to make good investments.
I really love that. And I think kind of the theme to that statement there is truly be running your own race and be staying in your own lane. And there's a reason why when you go to horse races, folks, the horses have blinders on for a reason, because you need to weigh out the other noise and you need to only consider, what you think in your gut is right and what makes sense. And, you may very well buy a property, at the unfortunate point of the cycle, but so long as you have good fundamentals, so long as you have a good business plan and you have the right debt and equity structure, you can live through any kind of economic time. Now, and if you also play the game correctly and your dollar cost average as well, what's going to happen? Well, over the course of time, you're going to get some grand slams, and there's some deals that you might, have a walk, which is just, maybe just good cash flow and accretive returns from a tax basis, right? But, the other thing I think about there is, the advantage of being an insider and controlling what you can control. And I think in our position uniquely, and you can speak to this and love your perspective, but, you kind of get inside information one way or another if you're in this place and you're really niche. And we're going to talk about the niches that you play in, but I think it's super crucial as an investor to realize, hey, there are pros and cons to investing at all points of the cycle. And no one's ever going to time the bottom perfectly, but just keep dollar average in there. But can you speak to kind of playing in a space where we kind of have, an inside angle on it due to the information that we have and, kind of the human element associated with real estate?
Oh, I think the important thing is to understand the human element, but also the psychology of investors. And there's a general sentiment, and that sentiment gives you the edge when it comes to investing. What I mean by that is, over the last, what, 6, 7 years, maybe, if you were out there to buy properties, well, we knew it was a seller's market, right? Sellers had the leverage, brokers had the leverage. They were going to go out there and demand or dictate the terms. You had to come in with hard money day one, and they set those terms and they could get it. Well, as that sentiment is shifting, and now more and more buyers are concerned and a little weary, we're starting to see that that power has shifted. And that's great for buyers. Those of us on the acquisition side, we now have a little bit more power when we're entering into these conversations. Brokers are calling me more now than they have in the last 5 years combined. Right. I mean, I got up a call, I had two broker calls earlier today, and that wasn't happening. They weren't proactively calling and reaching out, right? They pushed a button, they sent out a deal, they took in the offers, and I was the one calling them. And that's changed now. They're now calling me and asking me, hey, did you take a look at this? Hey, I may have something coming next week. Hey, what are your thoughts on this? And that wasn't happening. So when you talk about the psychology of it, the human element of it, many sellers are starting to get the come to the realization that the power dynamic has shifted. And now we are in a position where there's still a little bit of recalibration that's taking place. But if you absolutely have to sell in this market, you have to come to grips that the market's going to dictate the value. And that was not really the case 12 months ago. So I think it's really important for us as investors to, stay prudent with our approach, with our analysis. As you mentioned, stick to the fundamentals, understand your business plan, understand how you operate. And if you can do that, you can protect yourself and you can protect your investors. But more importantly, you can help everyone reach their financial goals.
That's awesome. I really, really like that. And to your point about brokerage, it is interesting right now. When the market gets super hot, all the hard work is on the front end, which is just getting the listing, getting the paperwork signed, and showing your competitive advantage when the market is kind of doing the hard work for you. Now, on the flip side of the coin, it's brokers. It's easy to get a listing. You don't want to take every listing right now because some sellers are a little high on the pricing where you just don't think it's good use of your time. And now it's the reach around process of calling, doing this, doing that, doing everything you can, literally turning every single stone to make sure there's no juice left to be squeezed there, which is super interesting. But some of the value I'm sure you're seeing, and we've gotten a couple of deals actually. The two deals that we're working through the first half of the year here for, through Q1 are two opportunities that we locked up in Q4 of 2022 or 2023, excuse me. That would be a long time, but two deals that we've locked up and been having through this first kind of quarter here. And those were deals that we didn't win right away. Those are two deals that, we hung around the hoop, as they said, and we're really patient and are now, recalibrating offers where we, they sent us, whisper price, their whisper price and what, reality were, two different stories. And then sure enough, one of the deals fell out. And then we were, the buyer there of choice where they came to right after. So, just if you are looking to buy deals right now, something to think about is, just because you don't maybe win the first go around does not mean the deal is going to close and does not mean you can get it for a way better price being the second husband.
Yeah, man, you gave two references that I don't know, man, it must be a Texas thing. I don't hear those as often. The second husband and hanging around the hoop. The hanging around the hoop is a good one. I'm like, man, I don't think I've ever heard anyone use that analogy before, but that's good. That's good. But
Well,
you're absolutely right.
the second husband comes from when I used to sell homes and whatnot. I say, hey, if you're the second listing agent, you're a lot better off being the first one because they went through the hard process of trying to get a price reduction, having that expire. So second time around, usually people change their approach.
That's it. And that's great. That's a great analogy because those sellers, they have to come to realization because they've gotten feedback, and I like to tell my kids and what they do with sports or whatever, listen, you're either going to win or you're going to get feedback. And if you can take that feedback and apply it, you can set yourself up to win the next time. But if you're stuck on a number and you're really persistent and almost being stubborn, then yes, you can keep hitting your head against the wall. But the great thing is, a lot of these sellers, they are going to get that feedback and they may take a property offline and maybe, adjust the property, adjust the financials, and then bring it back online, 6 months later, a year later. You see that too. And your point on hanging around the rim, I think that's a critical skill, right? So if on our show, Multifamily Insights, we like to give, when someone says a nugget that I think is really powerful, I like to stop and be like, hey, that's a great insight. The insight you gave there is that the deals are not. The deals are not found. Like I've never, I don't know about you, I have never underwritten a deal the first time. Numbers look great. I make an offer based on what that says. They accept it and we go through and close. I've never had that happen, right? There's always a little bit of back and forth and always a session where we have to look at it and get creative and say, okay, well, what if we did this? Well, what if we didn't push rents that much, but we also cut our renovation budget? Well, what if we got this kind of loan? So we're always kind of retooling it a little bit to figure out how can we make the deal work, not necessarily getting outside of the box or getting too aggressive, but just coming in with a different look at the business plan. And your point on hanging around the hoop, What you're saying is we just got to stay in touch. As they get feedback, maybe that seller warms up to an idea that they were a little off on before. Maybe that broker realizes, hey, there's not as much demand for this property as we thought. And even if they can get the number they want, maybe there's not that relationship. So you're actually the most credible buyer that's coming into the place. What if you were to offer more in earnest money as opposed to increasing your offer price, right? There are different levers you can pull, but staying in touch is one of the best ways because they're going to know you're a serious buyer if you're hanging around the hoop, following up and following and checking in on that deal.
Without a doubt. And it just goes to show that right now, relationships, we are in the relationship business. There's nothing that automation or AI can do to replace that. There's a human element, especially in our business, particularly. And with that point there, there's some times where we're throwing out kind of, courtesy offers just to help the broker out so they can get their price reduction or get their seller feedback. And guess what? They will return the favor to you if you're short on a deal or give you good information as to where you missed the mark if you miss out on a deal, and or make you the buyer of choice at some point as well, where you're gonna get an off-market deal to help you with your raising story where, you were the buyer of choice. A lot of people want off markets right now because a lot of institutions, when they, give groups like us equity, they're like, okay, well, why should we, work with you here? What value you're providing if this is just a market rate deal, right? Because we could have just went out there and bid it ourselves. So there's a mutually beneficial stream that comes from, being around there, having communication proper and following up and always just giving feedback one way or another. So I think it's super positive and that goes both ways. And you're gonna get the benefit one way or another if you are in fact doing that. With that said, would love to learn more and for you to kind of explain and break out, the two sides of your business. And I guess my first question, and I believe it's a little bit implied with the name of your podcast, but typically speaking, what type of deals do you raise for?
Yeah, multifamily, you know
Yeah,
that.
so only multifamily. Have you ever played in the self-storage or any other, sector, or have you just been niche super down into what you're in the apartment space?
Yeah, we're pretty much almost exclusively on multifamily. We are open to call it short-term rentals or guest stays. So we have some equity in hotels. That's an area where we're curious about and interested in with hospitality. There we have a strategic partner. That's the space they play in. We have a phenomenal relationship with them. So that's the reason we got into that space. But we love that area as well. We'll see if we do a lot more there. But I think about our business, we like the long-term rentals. I think the short-term and mid-term rentals in the right markets with the right business plan, with the right execution partners makes sense. But those are three different variables that make it a little challenging to come across. So we do like multifamily investments. We pr primarily like B-class value add deals. So we consider those properties areas where they come out of the gate with cash flow, but we have a very clear business plan to increase that cash flow. Usually that's going to be through renovations, but typically it could be some other operational component as well. Everything from utility bill back to reducing expenses, to managerial changes. So we're going to look at it and really think about how can we drive more growth, more revenue through this business and make it more profitable.
That's awesome. So tell me about the strategy. So you've got,
Yeah.
you said in-house, you do your own deals, of course, and you also bring equity for other folks, right? So can you kind of go through the strategy for, the deals in your backyard that you're, operating and running, what that looks like for you, and then we'll kind of go down to the ladder, which is the capital raising side of the business for, outside groups, please.
Absolutely. So let me give a holistic view of how we work with people, right? So starting off, we work with anybody who's looking to invest in multifamily. If you want to be an active investor and do your own deals and you need a little bit of help, we have an education platform that can help you gain the skills necessary to be a successful investor, right? So that's available. We have that through our Apartment Investing Mastermind. We also offer one-on-one coaching to help that person who wants to be active on the day-to-day side of this. Now, if you want to be passive, we have the opportunity to come and join us on our deals. So that's going to be opportunities that we source, we find, we bring to the table. And these are typically going to be exclusive opportunities that you wouldn't have access to without our relationship. So the way we focus on that side of the business, we look at deals in the Midwest, think about growing cities, think about areas that, have some prominence, Cincinnati, Columbus, Indianapolis, Louisville, Kentucky. Those are some of our core markets that we're looking at. I'm born and raised in Cleveland, and I have always wanted to do deals in Cleveland, but Cleveland's an interesting market where there's a lot going on. but the overall population growth isn't quite there. But there's some great dynamics. So we are starting to see more opportunities that are intriguing us in the Cleveland market. But we like those areas, right? I live in the Midwest. I'm in Cincinnati. I used to live in Chicago, born and raised in Cleveland, went to school in Dayton, lived in Detroit. I can get to most Midwest cities and have a fundamental experience and knowledge with most of those cities. So I like investing in areas that I know. It's that simple, right? When I'm bringing opportunities to our investors, I want to understand what part of town it is. I want to be able to make one or two phone calls and get the lowdown on the submarket if it's an area that maybe I'm not as familiar with. And then I'm going to drive over to the city. And I want to drive because I want to understand, the submarket. I want to drive around the neighborhoods. I want to go at multiple times a day. I want to get to the comp properties. I want to really get a feel for what a resident would experience living there, who lives there, where they work, why do they live there. I want to get a feel for all that. And sometimes it's hard to do that when you're just flying in, right? I want to get the full experience of all that. So that's the first part is investing in areas in the Midwest that are growing where we think there are strong fundamentals. The second part is we've been very fortunate and blessed to have conversations just like this, Craig, and meet some phenomenal people and phenomenal operators all over the country. What we have found is there are people we absolutely love and want to do business with, and we will partner with them if they come across a great opportunity and could use some help. So we've partnered with operators in Texas, we've partnered with operators in Georgia, the Carolinas, and in Florida. So if there are opportunities there with operators that we like, and we believe in them, we trust them, then we'll absolutely pursue opportunities in those areas. Typically, we're only looking to work with people that we've known for some time. Usually it's at least 1 year. Have had multiple interactions with them, understand the way they think, have some circle connectivity, meaning that we run in similar circles, and I can check up and say, hey, you have worked with them, or what's your experience like with this person? And kind of check in and make sure that this person matches our values and really brings the same kind of things to the table, but also that they're going to take care of our investors. And I think that's super important. So I know a lot of people who are looking to raise capital listen to this show. And one little insight that I can share is make sure anyone you work with has your investors in mind first and foremost. The second thing is make sure that they have reputational risk. What I mean there is you can partner with someone, and investors always ask about skin in the game. And I get it. It's a logical question for LPs to ask. Hey, do you have skin in the game? How much money are you investing? Most of us, and you get Craig, but most of us have skin in the game. That's not the thing I'm most concerned with. I'm most concerned with my reputation. I've spent the last 8 years building my personal brand, building these relationships, bringing my friends, family members, people closest to me to invest alongside me in these deals. I can lose my money because I know I can make that back. To lose these people's money, that's a whole other situation. And the reputational risk that I would take, it's not worth it to partner with someone who doesn't approach this business with the same level of concern. So for us, we're really careful on who we partner with, because for some people, it may just be, hey, you know what? They knew the risk. We made money, whatever. We lost money. Okay. I don't rock like that. So for me, it really comes down to I want to work with people who take this very seriously. Obviously, things happen. I'm not saying that everything's going to be perfect. But I want to work with people who are going to do everything in their power to protect themselves, protect our investors, and really work and partner with us in that capacity. So I think that's really key and critical. I think too often people get excited and just want to do a deal and get started, but they don't really take the time to build that relationship and understand, does this person really cherish that capital from your investors, the same way they would cherish it if it were their family or friends?
I love that. There's a lot to unpack there. And the biggest thing I think about when you mention all of that is the relate or the reputation and damaging that, because you're very young. I'm young. I'm 29, so I might be a little bit younger than you. Rob's young, Kent's young though. So relatively speaking, for the spectrum and the space that we're in, we have a very long tarmac to make a lot of money. But to ruin a reputation is a non-negotiable. So I couldn't hit on that more. And to even do one further, the kind of the conversations that I'm starting to have right now with a lot of people who may want to raise money for opportunities like ours, like, you know, partnering on our deals. And then also just for an investor is I really want to gatekeep, engage, you know, where are their mind spaces? Are they looking to only invest in deals that have the highest IRR, you know, whatever that may look like, not really even realizing, you know, and maybe ignorance is bliss, but not realizing the downside protection and risk-adjusted profile on these deals? Are they looking just to use you, you know, listening to certain keywords that they say, to really gauge where their head's at? Because I don't want to take everyone's equity and I don't want to work with everyone because we're married to these people potentially for 7 years if the deal doesn't go as planned, maybe 3 years if the deal goes really well. But we're really now in a normalcy market where, you know, business plans will actually be executed on a 5-year time horizon, not, you know, an 18-month horizon. So we want to be very diligent with who we allow to come into our capital stack. And I'm just not interested in working with people who are me, you know, worried too much about the front end, you know, costs there. And, you know, we want to make sure that we are, you know, marketable, but to, you know, prioritize that over, you know, their investors and giving that return is just very challenging in my opinion. So that's kind of the process that I see there that are some of the challenges, but the gatekeeping process is as far as kind of you were saying with, you know, what we're talking about currently in this marketplace.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, a great way for you to think about it. And, you know, in a very similar manner, one of the things I always like to do when we're talking to both operators and even LPs is ask pointed questions. I'm going to give you a great question to ask, by the way. Whenever you're looking to invest with someone, particularly when you are relinquishing control, whether that's you as a co-GP or a sponsor, or as an LP investor, ask about a deal that didn't go according to plan. And I like to just listen. And I don't really put too much weight into whatever happened in the deal. What I'm listening for is I'm listening for cues of, is this person going to take accountability? Are they a leader? Is there someone who will figure it out? Or do they blame the economy? Do they blame the property manager? Do they blame a partner? Is it always someone else's fault? Or do they take accountability for the things they can't control? And I'm not trying to imply that there aren't situations where you get screwed over by someone else. It certainly happened to me. But ultimately, I have to take ownership of how I allowed that to happen. I'll give you an example. We had a deal, it was a small property, 28 units, just me and my brother-in-law. So family JV deal. And I was not local. He was much closer. So there are things that, you know, I thought he was going to do, didn't really pan out exactly like that. But the short thing is, we had a contractor who stole $20,000 from us. We thought he paid the roofer. The roofer called me one day, threatened to put a lien on the property. I'm like, what are you talking about? I paid it. And, you know, we called the contractor. He's like, I don't know what the guy's talking about. Let me find out. And sure enough, this dude pocketed the money. Now, he absolutely took the money. He stole. You know, we tried to, you know, we went through the prison, filed a claim on all that stuff, right? Certainly not my fault, but I'm still responsible, right? At the end of the day, I still hired this guy. We did a background check, everything. So it's not like this was just a clumsy situation. We just saw this guy. We checked references. We did a background check. He did have a DUI charge, which was recent. We called him out on it to say, hey, what's going on? And in my mind, it's like, okay, poor decision making, but there was nothing that would indicate this guy would steal this kind of money, right? Nonetheless, we had to step back and change our process. How much money do we give to a contractor? Do we need lien signed prior to releasing these funds? All of those things changed our process. So it's a learning experience. And again, it was money that was my money. It wasn't LP or investor money, but that's the lesson learned. So when you are talking to operators, when you're talking to someone who you're going to give your money to, I want to hear what they learned from these experiences. I want to learn. I could tell that same story three different ways, right? I could tell it as, yeah, my partner didn't follow up with the guy and make sure he was doing with the thing, right? I could say this contractor was crooked and just stole my money. Could you believe it? But right. Or I could just say, you know what? This happened. I realized that we needed to have some better checks and balances in our processes to make sure that we don't have people who are stealing money or taking money from us. And we made changes to our process moving forward, right? We were able to recoup those funds. We were able to get the project, you know, finished, and we still made a profit. So ultimately, I want that person who will figure it out, whatever it is, right? Because you asked me about 2017 and a great time. Everybody did great then. That's not a great reflection. Like, I don't care about your track record because everybody did great then. Who are you when the proverbial crap hits the fan? That's what I want to know. You the guy who packs up your ball and flies home and I can't reach anymore? Or are you the guy who's going to stand up there and say, hey, John, this is what happened. It sucks, but I'm going to do everything I can to fix it. Here's what I'm working on right now, right? I want that guy. I want the guy who's ready to battle 300 by himself if he has to, as opposed to the guy who's going to look at it, tuck his tail, take his money, and cut out.
Without a doubt. And it's now the time when we're, need to go through the mud the most to get through the other side to make things happen. And I really appreciate you sharing a story that's probably not the most fortunate, but I'm sure you're so grateful that that happened, knowing you and your character, to have that happen not on a deal where, it's anyone else's money, but kind of internally there, as opposed to, the reputational damage that's there. And Rob and I really like this phrase, and it's almost silly, but we always say, if it rains, it's my fault. What do we mean? Well, if it rains, you had a chance to have an umbrella. You could have, properly planned ahead to do this, to do that. And you have to take accountability for everything, even though it's not technically your fault that it rained, but you need to, be perspicacious enough. You need to look around to see your surroundings and know what is going on around you. And then, to your point there, and just to run and trade a little game here, we've been doing this exercise called the dream investor or dream, kind of client interview, capital raiser interview, where we're basically just asking our top investors what they like that we're doing and what do you not like that we're doing? How can we get better? What other systems and processes are other people running and doing currently that is very easy for us to implement? Is there any easy low-hanging fruit? Because we'd like to think that, now improving, it's truly getting incrementally better. There's not that many holes in the ship, so to speak. So for us to get better and better each day, we really have to ask and reach out to say, what specifically can we do that the best are doing that we can do? Because we're young enough and humble enough to say, hey, we're not doing everything right, but we want to get it right. And we can only do that by asking and truly taking that feedback in, to your point. So I think it's super crucial to humble yourself, realize that there's always a lesson to be learned, an opportunity to get better, and a way to grow.
Absolutely. I love it all. It's interesting too when you say the rain analogy. In my head, I kept thinking like, well, there are things we can't control. And to your point, we can't control the rain, but we can control if we get wet. Right? To your point, we could have had an umbrella, we could have had other things. So I love that. And that's the thing about it. You know, it's just control what you can control, plan accordingly, have those conversations with potential partners, with investors, and that allows you to set yourself up for success.
Yeah, so now falling back into your approach for, tactically speaking on, the capital raising for your deals and then also for outside deals. So I'd be curious to know on your in-house acquisitions, and I think you said this before we got on air, but you're basically looking for deals that are within a 2-hour radius. So that's something that you look for, if I'm not mistaken. I would love for you to elaborate on that strategy. But talk to me about some of the key metrics that you get excited or that you need for you to feel comfortable with making an acquisition.
Well, the thing with the Midwest, and this is all regional based, right? So, one of the challenges I faced starting out is I would, go on blog posts or listen to podcasts or whatever, even talking to my mentor. And when I looked at their deal criteria, it just didn't really match what I was seeing in my market, especially the 1980s newer stuff. And I was like, I was in Chicago and then I moved to Cincinnati. Well, guess what? These are, Cincinnati is one of the oldest cities in the country. And Chicago has a bunch of 2 to 4 units. And then it has some like 12 units, some 20 units, but you don't have 200 unit apartment complexes in the city of Chicago that are like, garden style apartments. So you may have some high rises, but not garden style apartments. So when I was looking and trying to figure out my criteria, one of the challenges I faced was the information I was seeing wasn't really tailored to my market. So I started to really talk to more and more investors, and that ultimately turned into the podcast to learn how to find the best places to invest. So I say all that to say, you've got to figure out for yourself what's your investing style, what markets are you in, and then how do you create your own criteria. For me, I like B class value add deals. The reason I say B class is I like workforce housing where it's still desirable, where we can get market rate tenants. We get people who want to live there, can afford to live there, choose to live there, and they have a quality apartment where we can go ahead, renovate it, and they're willing to pay a premium for a little bit of a nicer apartment for whatever reason, whether they're saving up to buy a house or maybe it's a transitional for them or whatever the case may be. So that's the area we like to play in. I don't like the C-minus arena. I don't really like the AA-plus arena because I think those are two different demographics. And I don't feel that that business plan for me is as fulfilling. It's just not as fulfilling to, play in the luxury space where, I got to fight with every new builder that comes out there. The residents, if it's not white glove kind of service, you're gonna hear about it on Yelp or whatever, right? It's just a different demographic. And then on the C minus stuff, it's tough because, every dollar really matters. When you go up there and you're trying to push rents $50, I mean, that may or may not be $50 they have. So the goal for us isn't to just push and make money. The goal is to add value to a community, to add value to residents who want a nicer, fresher apartment that, is refreshed, that is a little bit newer, but it just simply doesn't exist in the marketplace. So there's a fulfillment aspect there. The second part of that is we like to look for deals and opportunities where we feel our approach and our business plan can be optimized. So, we don't want to do heavy construction. I don't want to break down walls and rebuild everything. We also want to go in and really focus on the operational side. My background is in business, right? I was in advertising and marketing. I oversaw, $100 million advertising budget. I had seven agency partners, project management, marketing, all those things are areas that I was pretty skilled at, developing a business plan, overseeing teams, overseeing the execution of an idea and a strategy. So that's what I'm really good at. When we get into, the minutiae of, something costing $3 a square foot versus $320 a square foot, it's not really my realm of expertise, right? I'm great at hiring and finding the right people and then letting them tell me, hey, if you do this, you would save, right? So just like when I was in the advertising world, I didn't go to creatives and tell them what words to put on a piece of paper. I told them, hey, here's what I need this to do. And I don't feel like it's hitting the mark right now. Can you go back and bring me some options? And then you let those creatives work, right? So the same thing. I'm working with my vendors, working with my specialists. If it's too high and it's not in budget, I'm going to tell them, hey, here's our budget. So you tell me how you get it in budget, whether that means, hey, John, we have to change materials or we need to do this or we need to do that. But give them the power and empower them to work, right? So that's a little easier again when you're closer to home, because I can make those personal relationships. I can talk to these people. The markets you mentioned, they're bigger cities. A lot of times brokers will have properties in multiple cities. So a broker who does Indianapolis may also do, Cincinnati. A broker does Columbus may also do Cincinnati. So I can have a handful of relationships and still reach both markets. So that helps us as well.
Awesome. And then is there any sort of like dynamic cap rate that you're looking for, or yield play you're looking for, or a lot of loss to lease story? What gets you most pumped when you see a deal that kind of feels the frothiest to you?
We start with our investors, so we want to make sure we can deliver products and opportunities that handle what our investors need. So probably very similar to what you guys look for. We're looking for kind of a mid-teens IRR, ideally in a 5 or 6 year hold. We want to double that equity. So that's kind of what we're looking at, and then we're looking to really reverse engineer our deals. Now, typically, the deals we're looking for and the cap rates and all those metrics you mentioned, we got to find something where the in-place value is maybe about 15% below what it should be. We like deals where there's an operational challenge because we feel those are a little easier, more direct to address. But sometimes it's harder to, uncover those things, and you have to really understand the market dynamics to uncover that. But we certainly like those kind of deals. On the cap rate, that's going to vary. I think that goes back to the B class kind of deal. So if you're playing in a certain segment, then the cap rate's going to fall in accordingly. So I don't want to say it's like a 5 or 6.5 cap or whatever. It's going to be whatever it is for the area. But if we can't create that kind of value, then the cap rate won't matter. What I will say, and this is my belief, others may not believe this, and that's fine. Because we are in the Midwest and certain parts of the Southeast region, I'm a firm believer of making sure that a proportionate amount of the returns come from cash flow. I think too often people rely too heavily on the appreciation. So one thing that you can always do is take a look and see how much of the returns are coming from cash flow. And how much of that is coming from the exit? And the reason this is important is twofold. One is, as an investor, you have to understand how your general partners are incentivized. you know, we like the pref return. It's a great way to make sure that our interests are aligned. But we actually, as a general partners, we don't make money until we actually hit that pref. So if you're in a deal for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and that general partner hasn't really made anything, they're going to be incentivized and have a little, you know, itch to go ahead and exit so they can get their portion, right? On the other side of that, we've got to think of downside protection. If you're in a deal where the equity comes on the sell and they're not making money, well, you may not have enough cash flow to stay in that deal a long time. So you're going to try to exit in 2, 3 years, as opposed to being willing to hold it for 5, 6, 7 years. And if you have a deal where now the investors aren't even making their pref return over a 5, 6, 7 year hold, that can get really problematic. So I like to ensure that the deals we do have strong cash flow, and stabilized cash flow, that is. And then we have the ability to sell or exit when it makes sense for us.
I really love that. And I think to the cash flow play, it's so funny. Investing just kind of got butt backwards in the last couple of years because everyone was doing these bridge deals where, you know, there's a massive lift at the end of it, but there may be no cash flow, or they overraise on the deal and they're just paying you back your principal and your initial payment via monthly distributions, which is a whole nother can of worms. I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of that for many reasons because the property's, you know, artificially paying you back cash flow when it's really not cash flowing at all when you look at the numbers. So, and if you don't have cash flow in there, effectively what you're doing is speculatively, you know, investing. And if you're going to speculatively invest, you should probably do that in a gateway market like Los Angeles, Miami now, you know, New York, or, you know, San Francisco. There's no point to do that, especially if you're in Texas. That just doesn't make sense. You know, that's kind of what Austin was doing. And now those speculative investors there are going to really struggle when there's 50,000 new units coming. Well, 50,000, what does that mean? That means there's about, you know, somewhere north of 10% of new supply coming. So that's a really scary metric. And that's going to turn into a lot of deals that are just going to be zombie deals that really can't churn through. And the one thing about the cash flow play that I really like is, you know, you're basically creating more certainty and you're at least giving your investors something and you can build off that, right? So if you're, you know, doing a deal where it's 8%, 7% cash flow, well, that's probably right around, you know, market beta of returns anyways. And now anything that comes on the sale is just gravy and it's basically, you know, investment alpha. So that's really important to do, especially now, people looking for that. That's focusing the right thing. And then selfishly, of course, if you're a sponsor, if you can get an 8% cash flow, well, hey, every cent on the exit there, depending upon where your pref rate is pure profit, or at least get your promote splits. So, you know, incentive interest and aligned interest there. And then also on top of that, the sponsor is uber compelled to want to have the biggest and, you know, lowest cap rate on the exit and really going to scrutinize as much as possible because he knows for every dollar he negotiates, he's going to get, you know, X amount of cents back. So that's very crucial from an aligned interest perspective. I guess on the other side of the coin, what are you looking for and what do you need to feel comfortable to move forward? You know, and I for, you know, bringing outside capital to deals to other sponsors, because naturally for you to, you know, feel comfortable there, there's a give and a take and an opportunity cost play and also a reputational, you know, stake, you know, component there as well. So be curious to know how you get comfortable and how you get behind another operator.
Yeah, I mean, our investing philosophy doesn't change as far as the deals we look at. When it comes to another operator, we want to make sure that they're like-minded, that again, a good portion of returns are going to come from cash flow, and that, you know, they have the right team in place to operate and exit. I think it really, you know, ultimately I want to see somebody who is like-minded, has the same values, has kind of the experience and track record. But most importantly, and this is something that most co-GPs and people in this space just flat out miss. The most important thing for me is that they respect me. And I don't mean that in a vague, lofty term. What I mean is, if we have a conversation, I want them to be able to listen to me and either implement what I'm saying or suggesting or give me feedback of why they want to go in a different direction. The biggest mistake I have ever made as a real estate investor was on a flip project where I partnered with a developer, and of course he quote unquote respect me for the money and stuff I was bringing to the table, but this was, you know, early in my, you know, my own personal portfolio, and I remember asking him questions because he was growing the amount of business he was doing. When I met him, he was doing four flips at a time, and very shortly after we started doing business together, he was up to eight flips at the same time, but he never grew his team, never added any employees or anything. And I said, hey, how are you planning on managing the growth, you essentially have twice as much work with the same amount of people. My concern is this is going to now take twice as long to get done. And he told me, oh, don't worry about that, John. And that was a huge red flag. Because guess what? I absolutely needed to worry about that. The whole thing came crumbling apart because predictably, they didn't have the manpower to execute. He didn't have the cash flow to pay more people, and it all came crumbling down. So whenever you are going to work with people, make sure they respect your opinion, because either one of two things are going to happen. I don't care. They say there's no such thing as a stupid question. If you ask me a question, either one of two things are going to happen. One is I'm going to hear you and take that into consideration and make adjustments, right? And say, wow, you know, that's great feedback. Why don't we dig into that and let's see if that's something we need to incorporate. Or I'm going to explain to you why that's not a concern. I'll tell you one of the questions I got, the hardest question I've received from an LP investor, especially starting out, right? Because I want to be buttoned up and be ready to go. I want to answer every question, every objection. And this guy asked me, he said, this is around 2017. So Trump had just kind of taken office. And he said, what are you going to do if they tighten up the border? Because I see a lot of Texas's growth is coming from immigration reform. And I'm like, dude, I was ready to go with every answer, in my opinion, on the deal. Like, I had not thought once about the Latino immigration for the state of Texas and what would happen. I'm like, dude, I got to research that one. So I was like, great question. Let me dig into this and get back to you. So I did a bunch of research on how many residents who were moving into Texas and this specific market were, you know, coming in through some sort of immigration or green card. Or I did all this research, right? And then I came back with what my response was. But it was a great question. You know, it was a great question. You get other questions that you can answer right away, or, hey, you know what? We've got 50,000 people over here. Not really worried about that. But again, my point is you should be able to answer it. If it's truly not a concern, then I should have an answer ready to go for you. If it is a concern, then it's something we just have to dig into more. But if anyone tries to dismiss it, I'm out. I would not work with someone who doesn't respect any concern that I bring. And I don't care how crazy or stupid it is. If you don't take it seriously, I'm out.
And I really like that. And I think anyone who's in sales or getting into this business, just realize that it's really inappropriate to BS something and make something up. What is not inappropriate and actually very respectful to your theme there is saying, that's a great question, let me get back to you. And coming up with that, because you and everyone's realistic, you don't have to have all the answers and you don't have to be right. Just get it right. And let me know what you think. Consult with other people and get better. But you're not getting better by just making stuff up. You're actually probably digging yourself in a hole because your LPs aren't stupid. So don't disrespect their intelligence, especially if they're looking for you, you know, for some insight there. And you know what? The beauty is, and this is why I love talking with people like you, partner with folks like yourself, and you know, the people that are in our ecosystem, is because guess what? They're also really successful people who are in multiple deals and multiple markets and experiencing a lot of things similarly like you. So it's very crucial to take people's input and exactly be respectful and to align yourself with awesome people. With that said, we got to wrap up here. You've been such a great guest. Do you have any real estate hot takes or any kind of contrarian opinion that are true to you that maybe other people don't have, or anything that's a little bit outside of the norm?
I think the biggest thing is just stop listening to this noise about the recession and interest rates and everything else. Like, we can't control those things. Control what you can control. And if your goals are to, you know, get financial freedom or time independence or, you know, whatever it is, and you need to invest in real estate in order to do that, focus there. Don't listen to somebody who has a completely different outlook. You know, I love my peers in this space, but you have to understand a lot of them are playing a different game. They're out of the W-2 job. They fix that. So they're looking at it from a, you know, wealth preservation standpoint, not a wealth creation standpoint. So they have the ability to sit on the sidelines and wait and cherry pick. If that's not you, and the alternative is, well, I'm going to stay in this W-2 job another 2 or 3 years while I wait for the market or wait for the economy to be perfect to invest, you're doing it wrong. So focus on the long-term gain. Focus on the fundamentals of investing and always be looking at deals.
I love that. Once more, John, you've been such a great guest. Where can people find you, get in touch with you, and get into your ecosystem? They're looking more to just connect with you. Maybe if you want, don't mind sharing where you're currently living, because I know we have a lot of investors and listeners that are all across the nation that, might be nearby to you that would like to connect and invest locally. How can people find your podcast, get in touch with you, the whole nine?
Yeah, the easiest thing is you can go to our website and go to kasmancapital.com/sample deal. We have a sample deal package available, and it's actually a great resource whether you want to be active or you want to be passive, because it gets into terminology, deal structure, market things to look for. It's a great, really, background on kind of what to do. And I think it's great because whether you want to be active and you want to know what you should be including in the deals that you're presenting, or you want to be passive and you want to get a sense of, well, what questions should I be asking or what should I be looking for, it can really frame up that for you. So that's at kasmancapital.com/sample deal. And as you alluded to earlier, we do have our own podcast called Multifamily Insights. We talk to great guests all the time who help us with everything you need to be a successful multifamily investor. That podcast is available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show. Hopefully, we can get you as a recurring guest in the future. For everyone listening, thank you so much, and we'll see you next week. Peace.